sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Volatility rises as volume picks up. Economic data coming in a bit softer than expected. Oil drops and the dollar rises again. And our guest today, Frank Curzio from Curzio Research. All this and much more on episode number 476 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hello and welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and of course, you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, where we bring some great guests, some hopefully good commentary, and some information to help you with investing, understanding a lot of the components about the world of money, finance, and a lot of other information about business in between that. And we have a great guest today. As a matter of fact, we're going to spend a good amount of time with him, Frank Curzio, one of the favorites of this show. And we'll get to him in a second. I just have a few things that I wanted to touch on before we actually got to our discussion with Frank. First of all, I mentioned at the open of the show that, clearly volatility has increased. We saw that volume has been coming back to the markets, and whether or not it's due to the fact that this week coming up, we have the Fed with their two-day meeting and their rate decision. A lot of speculation has been as to whether are they going to hike a little bit, maybe nothing, hold it off to the end of the year. I still think that the end of the year is the more probable, but again, it's not worth wagering on that, I guess, for many investors. We saw rates rise a bit, the dollar come up, and even in the face of weaker than expected economic information that has been reported recently in the U.S., it doesn't seem to matter much as traders are squaring up ahead of this meeting. We all talk about what's the difference, a little 25 basis point move, possibly a continuation of reinvestment of interest and maturing debt by the Fed keeps interest rates low to a degree, keeps some demand for U.S. treasuries. So that's why we're seeing, of course, the extremely low rate of interest when it comes to either mortgages or treasuries. We'll see what happens. I really don't think it's worth at this point trying to speculate or even get ahead of, in front of, the actual positioning later this week. A couple other things before we get to Frank. First of all, if you have any questions, I told you about that new area on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And of course, you can get all the show notes and information about the various discussions we have with our guests. You can search podcasts. But you could also ask me a question. Before we had emails and it was not as easy to deal with, but now we have a very easy to deal with area on the website. Just go to the top bar where you see Ask Andrew and you can ask me a question. We'll have it on the show. As a matter of fact, next week's show is dedicated to answering many of the questions that came in. Got a good amount of questions. But if you have something about whether it's, a particular area of finance that maybe you want some clarification on, something that's been confusing you about maybe a show that we did and some topics that we talked about, or maybe even some discussion about a particular investment. That's what we're here to discuss, and I will answer those, many of those, a good chunk of those, on the next episode next week. And of course, for those of you who are still interested in knowing a little bit more, last week we talked about the whole discussion of the potential for bonds, fixed income, to be at somewhere about the lowest we're going to see maybe in the next few decades in terms of their rate. And if you have some concern like I do about how to position your portfolio correctly, you can go there as well and you can ask a question if you'd like. Or as a matter of fact, there's a link I'll put in this show episode again so you can have an opportunity to ask me that question directly about your particular bond fixed income portfolio. It's something that I'm pretty concerned about in terms of positioning, because those long bonds could have a significant amount of volatility and potential for losses on principal. And at these low rates, there's not a lot of leeway there when it comes to gaining back your original monies that you invested, especially if you did so recently. You see that bond prices are at some of the highest we've seen in years and maybe even ever, especially those that are longer term. And you have to understand that mutual funds don't actually do, they don't buy you in a par. You're buying whatever the price is at the time that you actually buy in. Same thing to a degree with ETFs. So again, just a recap of some of the things we talked about last week. And if you hadn't had a chance to listen to last week's show, I think you should do so. Anyway, with that in mind, it's that time to bring on our guest. And that's Frank Curzio, president and founder of Curzio Research and host of the wonderful podcast Wall Street Unplugged. Now, Frank has been traveling a bit and going to some great conferences. And we were talking the other day and I said, you know, Frank, why don't you come on the show and let's talk about some of the things that you've been doing, because it's been pretty exciting. And, you know, you can't keep all that stuff to yourself, buddy, right?
Yeah, I know. I always share my close friends. So, and that happens to be you, actually.
And both of us, a little bit. Yeah, thanks. And our podcast audience. I mean, to be honest, it's kind of an extended family in a way, right?
Absolutely. It is a family. It's a network. You get close to these people. You realize how hard they work. And, you know, they rely on your advice. And also, we rely on their advice, too. Because, you know, it's a network that you know as well, Andrew, that it's not just U.S. or national, but it's global, where you get emails from all over the world.
Yep.
Tell me exactly what's going on. It's really cool stuff, man.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So let's talk a little bit about let's start out. I have a lot of notes and things and a variety of topics that I want to talk about with you. But one of the last times you were on, we had been talking about, I think it was two shows ago, probably, which is a number of months ago. And by the way, for anybody listening, if you want to know when Frank Curzio was on the show, maybe you want to listen to something that he said some time ago. You want to think about what stocks he was talking about. If you go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and on the top, there's something that says podcast search. You click that and you can actually pick any of the guests that have been on over the last 7 years and just click that guest name. And all the shows that they appeared on and all the stocks we talked about and a variety of things are right there. So you can play right from there any of the discussions on that show. So it's kind of a cool place to find where Frank was on, one of the most frequent guests and beloved of the show. But let's talk about Apple a little bit. So Apple comes out with their brand new iPhone. They have a watch that is finally now going to be able to be submerged, and you know, it actually has 50 meter depth, which is pretty impressive. The phone's still not totally waterproof, but they come out with this announcement, and the stock kind of sagged a little bit. I think there was a little bit of disappointment initially, and then all of a sudden, 2 days later, boom, it just sparks right up. So, what's your kind of thoughts on this, and maybe the play, because you were kind of very cold on it some time ago.
Yeah, I was really cold on it. This is going back probably a year, and I think 98% of the analysts, which is over 50 analysts covering the stock, had a buy or strong buy rating. I don't know the difference between a buy and a strong buy. Maybe you could tell me that one day. But anyway, I consider them all buy ratings.
Right.
So it was around 129, 130. That's when Icon was going on TV saying, you know, they're going to increase their dividend, they're going to do this and that, and Apple's great. And then, you know, again, the stock has run up and kind of he doesn't even have a position anymore. We'll get to that a little later. But you're looking at Apple, you're looking at their estimates, they were way too high. They're actually still too high right now, but there's one change to the thesis, and it's not that I hated Apple in the 100, 103, 104. I just thought it'd be more of a market stock, and right now it's actually outperforming, but there's a significant difference here, Andrew. Samsung really dropped the ball, and I think that's going to – you're going to see that where you're not only getting more optimism, it's probably going to result in much, much more sales to these Apple iPhones and the new phones, which is important, right? Because especially – the Samsung was one of the phones. This one and the last model were two phones that were actually a little bit competitive with Apple. Usually you couldn't even touch them, right? But it was the first time in my life that people were showing me their Samsung phone and saying, look at this. This is awesome. This is great. Takes great pictures, better pictures. And this was supposed to be the year where their model, their 7, was supposed to be fantastic. And what happened is they had to recall all these phones because they start fires. I just took a flight to New York to the Delivering Alpha Conference, which we'll get to in a little while. on every single flight. They're announcing if you have a Samsung phone, you have to shut it off. We don't want fires on a plane. And they were even, not only did they announce it on the flight there and back from New York, which I'm in Florida now, they were announcing it on loudspeakers in the airport. So the whole entire world knows this, and I think that that's a big bonus to Apple, and you'll probably see it run up. With that said, I think this is going to be a temporary move. You're going to see a little, probably go a little bit more higher. I think the estimates are saying they're sold out already, and they're great. The estimates are still way, way, way too high from these analysts. Almost every one of these analysts have buy ratings still on the stock, and I don't see much upside from here. I just see better opportunities, especially after the 15% run we've had in the past couple of weeks. Since kind of like, I mean, you said it. When they announced the iPhone, we all knew it was going to come out. The stock didn't really do anything. But when this whole Samsung problem really started, you know, hitting news and, you know, going mainstream and going viral, that's when you saw Apple stock move. So,
what you're saying is we're buying Apple out of default. In other words, if all things were considered to be equal, if there was no mini bombs in the Samsung Galaxy Notes, that one product, if there was no other changes, you may not be as the analysts and others that are buying the stock may not have been as optimistic about this, because there would still be competition. The tell me if I'm right or wrong when I finish this. The iPhone 7 is an incremental better refresh, if you will. There's not much that really moved the needle that much, except for the fact that now all of a sudden the other choice that was the, like, okay, am I buying the Samsung Galaxy Note or am I buying the Apple iPhone? Or if I have a Samsung, maybe I'm going to change now because of this whole situation. You're saying that just leaned it all towards Apple's benefit.
Even the people that were on the fence are the people who first purchased, because Samsung's obviously taking away market share, right, for the first time. And it's not that much. You know, Apple is still the dominant player in this industry when it comes to their iPhones. But people were switching over, and I think when you look at this and you look at the recalls, and remember, it's not just, oh, well, they're going to buy the iPhone instead of the Samsung. These people are making life changes, right? Because you have all your music. It's an ecosystem. Once you're on it, it's very difficult to get off, because you have your iPad, you have everything, you know, links with each other, you have kids, and everything's in sync, even the iPads and stuff. And then when you go over to a whole other system, it's kind of difficult. Your content, everything being moved. So getting someone over to the exit is hard enough. And then now that this callus happened, I'm just saying that this point right here is probably going to result in a little bit better numbers than expected. The analysts themselves have still been optimistic, but I think the reason why you've seen the stock move up here is mostly because of that Samsung. And I'd probably look to take profits here because you know, the expectations are really high. They're going to sell really good with this phone, but after this phone, it's very difficult for this company to continue to generate money when it comes to the estimates that they're looking at, where $250 billion in sales are this company's estimates over the next few years. That's what they're going to have to generate annually. It's nearly impossible. Just to put that in perspective, you're looking at, you know, the watch generated. I mean, they don't break it out, right? Why don't they break it out? Because it's a horrible seller for the company. It's a great seller for a company that you and I may have started, and maybe 480 companies on the S&P 500 would be a good product. But it generated a lot less revenue, because you know as well as I do, when it comes to companies, they want to be more transparent with the best things that are going on. And if the watch was selling that big, they'd break it out. They don't. They put it under one umbrella. And even that umbrella is generating $5, $10 billion, and not just the watch, but they put it in with a whole bunch of other things. But $10 billion doesn't move the needle on a company that's supposed to generate $250 billion, and most of those sales come from the iPhone. So you're going to see sales go through the roof. Slow down next period and the next two quarters, it's going to be really, really difficult. So I think as a trade, you know, I take profits here. You may see the stock move up a little bit more, but over the next 6 to 9 months, I think the stock's definitely going to be a lot lower than where it is right now.
So let's talk a minute. Let's shift away from Apple. By the way, we're not Apple haters or lovers or anything like that.
All.
We're
just
talking
about,
you know, I love Apple products. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they're great. You know, I thought about changing here and there, and I'm like, oh, I can't do that. You know, I thought, oh, maybe I'll get a PC this time versus my laptop, you know, a laptop on the Windows platform. Mm-hmm. And I looked at them all. I'm like, oh, I'm not doing that. I'm going to stay with the Apple for my laptop. Yeah. You know, and then you look at the various tablets, which I don't even use my tablet that much as I used to since I got the iPhone 6 Plus, 6S Plus, mm-hmm. because it's just big enough. I mean, it's big enough. You could do what you got to do. And, you know, it's not as – it's funny because – once you go, I don't know if you have the plus size, but once you go plus, you look at the other phones, you're like, oh my God, that's small. You look at your original iPhone.
I definitely have the plus size. I'm kidding. My wife actually has the plus. And it's cool for her because you can put it in a pocketbook. For me, I love it. And the pictures that they take is amazing compared to just the regular version, the non-plus. But For me, it's where do you put it? Like you put it in pocket, you sit down. It's a really, really big phone, and it does really take you away from iPads, which I use all the time too. But and I find myself using a little bit less, even though I don't even have the Plus. I just go on my phone more. But it's such a big phone that for me, it's difficult to just carry around. But I hear you. It is great.
Yep. All right. Let's talk about this. You were recently at the Delivering Alpha conference, and you were doing a lot of tweeting on that. What's your tweet? What's your Twitter address? Your Twitter handle?
At Frank Curzio.
That's easy enough. At Frank Curzio, his Twitter handle. And basically, you were doing a lot of tweeting. You were talking about a variety of different things that were happening. I know you had front row seats. You were right there in the thick of things. You were paying attention, taking notes, not dozing off. Was there a big change to what you felt was the overall vibe in terms of markets in the room compared to some of the other conferences you've gone to?
Not so much. I mean, what CNBC is going to report, because they hosted it, is they're going to report like the hot topics, right? They want to get as many page views as possible, just like everybody else. And I'm not putting them down. But for me, when I look at things, I want to hear what they're saying, because just from what they're saying and what they're seeing in their research teams and their global, I could go out and identify so many mid-cap, small-cap stocks, even micro-cap stocks that my audience can make a fortune on because of trends that these guys see because of how big they are. And that's what I'm interested in. For example, when you see, you know, explain the lineup there, Jim Chanos, Bill Miller, Carl Icahn, Ashbel Williams is a guy who manages over $150 billion assets for the Florida State Pension Fund. Mary Callahan, one of my favorites. I loved her. She's runs J.P. Morgan's asset management division, $1.7 trillion in assets under management. Mm. Ray Dalio, Paul Singer, the Treasury Secretary was there, Jack Lew, CEO of Blackstone, $300 billion assets. These are the people that were on their stage. So much where the 300 people in the audience around and also everybody who presented represented more than $3 trillion in assets under management in this room. That's how big, $3
trillion. Wow.
So, I mean, it's one of the premier conferences, and it's very expensive to get in. But when I'm looking at these guys, and going back to your question, a lot of them are cautious. Some of them extremely cautious, even to recommend buying gold and gold stocks. You saw a lot of mining picks, like Tech Resources was one of them, showing that, you know, here's an industry that's been beat up. Yes, it's up off its lows at an incredible run, but if you look at the whole picture 4 years ago, they're still down incredibly, still 40, 50, 60% from their highs from 2012. But there's so much nervousness around interest rates, around bonds. And remember, we're talking about the elite, right? So these guys are not like you and I, Andrew. They're not like the people who listen to our podcast. We have a significant advantage over these people. We could go in and buy small cap, mid cap stocks, micro cap stocks. These guys can't do that. Most of this, they're so big. They're talking about, you know, cross currencies. How do we take advantage? They're talking about the regulation, the fiscal policy, how there's so much more regulation and they want less regulation. But this happens to be really good for them because it forced the European banks to get out of a lot of their risky assets. So they're selling real estate portfolios for pennies on the dollar, where these guys were able to pick them up and they're making a fortune now. Right? We talk about 2011, 2012 for Europe, even earlier in America. So you're getting these big firms and banks that were forced to come out of this market, and the hedge funds with all this capital and even private equity firms are like, hey, I'll take this stuff.
I'll take
this stuff
it,
is dirt cheap.
Right.
No problem. I'll generate fees forever on this, and I'll make a fortune on it. So they're very nervous. They're looking at the bond market. They feel like nothing that we already don't know, kind of, that they're taking on, and they see more clients taking on an excessive amount of risk to generate little return, right? Because interest rates are so
wait, they're
low.
Saying they're seeing clients desiring taking on excessive amount of risk compared to what they should be taking to get any kind of yield. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
To me?
Because if you're looking, 30% of the bond market, all bonds globally are yielding 0% or lower, so negative. So what they have to do in order to generate those returns is they have to take on more risk, and they're getting more risk, but they're not getting those returns. And here you have is all these hedge fund managers on stage telling them, the fee question came up a ton. Hey, you're charging 2%, 20%. Your returns are below the S&P 500. You generated 3, 4, 5, 6% returns over the last 12 months even. How do you, account for that fee structure? And they really, you didn't hear any answers. They were like, well, you can't compare us to the S&P 500 because we're long and short. Well, I should be comparing it to the S&P 500 because your clients probably think that. And I understand where they're coming from.
Well, hold on a second. Listen, you can't compare, let's say a guy has a hedge fund. And his hedge fund is gold stocks, just as a point of reference, right? I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily appropriate to compare them to the S&P 500 because somebody that wants positions, you know, mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody that's a long short, I don't know. I mean, you know, depending on what, well, let's say it this way. Depending on what the fund is structured to do and what their goals are initially, not changing their tune, but initially, that's what you should compare a benchmark to. If you got a hedge fund that's you know is going to be, I don't know, whatever it would be, let's say 50-50 stocks and bonds, just that's, you know, make this up, 50, then your benchmark is 50-50 stocks and bonds.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. The thing that I didn't agree with is, and again, their alternative funds, they're getting into different assets, but these guys had no problem, a lot of these guys that I know had no problem comparing their returns to the S&P 500 when they were blowing them away 4 years ago, six years ago. And now they're like, no, well, you know, and I just think when you look at the market and you throw in those, if you're not throwing in fees and you charge a little bit of fees, you know, I understand, but the fact that you should be outperforming everything in the world if you're charging 2%, 20%, because those fees are absolutely insane, and they really, really, really eat into your returns. Like, you could generate 10%, 15%, 17%, 20% 4 years in a row, right? And then they're collecting monster fees, and then you have a crash like 2008, and the stock comes, you know, the whole market comes down, your portfolio is down 40%, right where you started at, and yet these guys collected how much in fees off of you? And yet their performance, your portfolio is exactly where it is from 4 years ago. So it's hard to justify.
I hear you. And especially the hedge fund environments. Different when you have, like, the big thing is the incentive fees. That's the bigger part of the 2% and 20. You know, that's the bigger issue. I mean, we charge, you know, depending on what kind of portfolio that we manage, you know, we're going to charge for our global allocations anywhere, you know, it could be, well, let's just say we start 2% and down, you know, depending on what it is and depending on the size of the portfolio and all that. But the big difference is the incentive fee. That's where the big money comes from. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a big difference.
Yeah, no, and it's amazing. And you know, this is why I say that the people listening to your podcast, people listening to my podcast, have a tremendous advantage too, Andrew. And you're looking at these funds where they're going to get paid based on performance, right? And that performance is whatever benchmark they choose, right? You just can't not have a benchmark.
That's where the problem comes in.
And they're not. Right. They're like, well, we don't have it. Well, what is the benchmark? Whatever it is, they should get paid on whether they beat that benchmark. Now, here's a situation that's taking place where, if you have a good first or second quarter and you're up a ton, right? Why risk those assets?
Right.
Why?
Right.
Why don't you say if you have like you're up 10% on the first two quarters? You know, if you're a hedge fund manager, the way the fee structure and the way our market, it almost promotes you to take all those assets out, right? Because you're not allowed to go in cash because you don't get paid on cash, right?
Right.
Take all that money out, and what are you going to buy?
Bonds.
Exactly. No, not even but treasuries, right?
Right. Right. Of course,
the safest. Right. Who cares? You know, you're not going to lose money. Yes, you lose money over time, inflation, but you put them in the least risk as possible. And it's funny how you're seeing the dollar so strong, and people are like, how could you buy treasuries 10 years where they're yielding, and after 20 years it's worth? This is why. Well, you see, we're not talking about just $10 billion, $20 billion. $3 trillion was being represented just in this room that I was in. So,
but the bigger problem is, Frank, let me just kind of, we'll go on from this because we're probably boring people a little bit with this, but with the minutiae of some of this. But you know what's really interesting is when the hedge funds get behind their benchmarks and their high watermark. And let's say that, you know, again, you know, their 2% is like what they consider their administrative costs of running the whole thing, plus their, their incentive fee, the 20%, let's say. But when they get behind the benchmark, and when they, let's say for a number of years, and then they get behind on their watermark, what do they do a lot of times? They close the fund, right?
Yep.
And then they just open a new one so they could start from scratch. That's where it becomes really a problem.
No, absolutely. And again, we don't want to, but you know, the point of this, and this way, you know, we bring everyone in here, is these guys can really only focus on the major things.
Yep.
Fees are huge to them, right? Their businesses, a lot of these, even private equity firms who are there, not only just hedge funds, but you know, they have publicly traded stocks, and you need to generate profits, right? So they need to charge fees. But for individual investors, you can get in and out of so many. You could take advantage of the inefficiencies you see in small caps, in mid caps, and even in micro caps, where these guys can't, because they're just so big and they can't get in and out, that they have to buy the largest companies of the world. They got to do cross-currency stuff. They have to do alternative investing. So I just think it provides a huge advantage for
they're not nimble.
Investors.
They're not nimble. Bottom line is they're not nimble. And to try to turn the ship is pretty remarkable. Now, let's talk about something that happened there. You know, you had, like you mentioned, you had Chanos there. So we knew Chanos is going to talk. He's going to be negative on Tesla. He's going to be negative on SolarCity, right? He's going to be, you know, talking about how maybe the China market is still a really bad situation, et cetera. Bill Miller is going to be giddy about something, right? You know, he was giddy on...
they were on stage together.
Oh, they were. Okay. So he's giddy maybe about Valiant, thinks it's a great opportunity. You know, you should put a lot of money in there. I know he was talking about, I think, Amazon. So we kind of know some of the players, what they're going to talk about, right? And we know why they're going to talk about it. Absolutely. Because they're going to, you know, they want to, especially in this kind of situation, which is having a lot of coverage, they want people to listen and to buy along because it's their book. Why not, right? Now, one of the things that's interesting was that Carl Icahn was there. Now, somewhere in the midst of his discussion about how markets are so awful and all that kind of good stuff and bonds are overpriced and his issues with the ETF, bond ETFs, he talked about Herbalife. This is the most bizarre thing that he is so attracted to. It is clearly to me not his desire and love for this stock as a company, but rather a smackdown of Ackman. That seems logical and obvious to me. But he mentioned that he's going to take his stake possibly up to 50% of the company, even after the company was fined a few hundred million dollars.
What's the biggest word you just said in that sentence? Possibly.
Oh, possibly. Listen, before you say anything, how about our theory? We came up this the other night. He's just doing this so he can sell into it.
Absolutely. And that's not your thing. I mean, if I had a huge rant on this on my podcast, Wall Street Unplugged, two weeks ago, and I've ranted about this a while ago. I mean, here you have Icahn. Let's go back to the Apple situation. I think the stock was trading probably, if I had a guess, 105, 106, 107, and he said that the company is going to double their market cap. This isn't a small cap company that comes up with, you know, a good sales year or whatever that can easily double revenues, double their market cap. You're talking about the biggest company in the world adding $500 billion in market cap to its company. That's his. That was his. That he went on to, they're going to buy back stock. It's going to double. It's going to have, you know, this $1 trillion valuation, all this stuff. And, you know, everyone's like, wow, Icahn's buying, you know, and he got to talk to Tim Cook, got to manipulate Tim Cook, in my opinion, forcing him to buy back probably more. I mean, you're looking at Jobs would have never, ever did that. He wouldn't even talk to Icahn.
Right.
Tim Cook sat down with Icahn, actually increased their dividend, bought back more stock using that cash. And what happens, you know, like 2 months later, he's totally out of his position. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. And did you? He's like, well, I don't know if China's. He said he doesn't know if China's sales are going to be that great. And this is nothing against Icahn because this is perfectly legal. He's smart to do this. I'm not. I like Icahn. He was hilarious. He was by far the best speaker there in terms of entertainment. But you have to realize as an individual investor what's going on here. I sat 4 feet, I had the best seat in the house, 4 feet from everybody that came on that stage, right? I have videos, I have pictures, 4 feet from. I'm pretty good at analyzing people all my life and stuff like that. That's how I made a living. He doesn't really like the company right here. The company definitely, it changed. Yes, it's good news that it's not a Ponzi scheme, so which means Ackman should actually be selling his position, right? Because his whole entire thesis, and he went to you know, Washington to make sure he could get, you know, to try to sue this company, have lawyers on his side and politics and politicians and stuff. He went crazy, right? He even created websites that say, you know, it's fraud.com, whatever it is. Now his thesis is wrong because they came out and said it's not a Ponzi scheme. But the things that were enacted in that company is definitely going to slow growth.
Yeah.
So it doesn't look like a positive either. So which means if you look at an Icahn, his thesis shouldn't matter either. Well, his thesis of buying the stock doesn't make sense. And he was trying to convince everybody of why he liked it. And one of the biggest things is, Andrew, is the short position. He goes, a professional investor would never take that massive of a short position and do what he did. He's like, because I own, you know, how much percent of the company, 20% plus, and he has the ability to go up to 35%. And Ackman said the fact that he didn't go up to 35% means that, you know, he's just going to sell the stock. So what did Icahn do? I think he bought like another 2 million shares. And he just came out with that news. That was launched on the Delivering Alpha conference where he said, I filed to increase my stake up to 50%. To me, I would be selling that news. I think you're going to look at Icahn getting out of his full position because the stock, I think the stock is overvalued. I loved Herbalife a while ago. I told everybody, he said, listen, if Ackman had 3 years to prove it was a Ponzi scheme and he didn't, it's not a Ponzi scheme. And the stock went a lot higher.
But let me tell you something. My analysis on the results of the fine and the findings was that, first of all, the company couldn't be, you know, doing nothing wrong if they got a $200 million penalty against them. That's first of all. Something had to be wrong. Second of all, the company was required to change their entire sales recruitment practice and a bunch of other things, which was the basis of what they were, what made them good, you know, what made them profitable. And so now they have to change the whole company. What's really interesting is I agree with you that Ackman's thesis is busted because while it may have actually been some kind of a Ponzi multi-level market, whatever the deal was, somehow they figured out how to finagle their way out of it by paying this penalty instead. There was something not right. They had to pay a $200 million penalty.
It was aggressive marketing tactics that a lot of firms use, but the bottom line is a Ponzi scheme is almost like
illegal
and negative.
Yeah,
I didn't see that coming. You know, like I didn't see that when I did my analysis, but it definitely, you know, the sales practices are very, very aggressive and they got funny. They obviously did something wrong. So we're both in agreement. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so then Ackman's thesis is busted. Now, if he wants to come up with a new one saying, well, the reason why I'm doing this is this, but you know what? You wouldn't have that much money on the line on the short side with the new thesis, which is the company's just not going to do great, you know, versus it being taken down. Icahn's thesis is busted too, because his thesis was great company, mm-hmm. it's going to make all this money. But wait a minute, we just found out that they have to change their entire practice, which is why you like the company to begin with. So I'm back to that Icahn's just looking to get out of the stock. Icahn's looking to bust Ackman. The possibility that when Ackman came out and said that Icahn was shopping his shares around, Icahn was pissed off that was let out of the bag.
He was. I think he was denying that completely. And the fact that just him saying he wants to push that limit up to, remember, you got to have the shares available, right? So you got to be able to buy these. And you know, so the shares are the short. And if you're looking at the percentages, I mean, it could result in one of the biggest short squeezes you ever see in your life, especially if Icahn decided to actually purchase the whole company and say, okay, this is what we're going to do. And he said, I don't know. Maybe but he hinted at that too. He goes, I think they'd be better off private. You know, so he's doing, again, this is all media manipulation. This is what they do. And it's perfectly legal. And I'm not saying anything bad about Icahn, I'm a big fan of. But I'm in agreement with you where he's not looking to take 50% stake in this company. Even as much as he hates Ackman, maybe he will, but it's more of a ploy to try to get out of this stock and try to create maybe a little short squeeze or see what he could do and push that stock higher to create that more liquidity to get out. Again, that's perfectly legal, and he's been doing that for a while now, not just with Apple, but with other stocks as well. And he's been using TV outlets and Twitter and stuff like that to actually do it. Otherwise, why would a guy who's worth billions and billions of dollars, his life is set, he's over 8, why is this guy even going on TV for?
It's a big game. It's a big game.
Hedge funds never went on TV. There's all secrets. These guys are going on TV. They say, hey, if you want us on TV, fine. How is it going to work for my advantage? This is how it's going to work for Icahn's advantage. Okay, CNBC, you're going to get the viewers. You're going to get to ask every crazy question, try to make me fight with Ackman, which they tried to do on stage, and he wouldn't take the bait. He's like, I'm a fan of his, and you know, this and that. But that's why they're using TV as that outlet, because they know they can generate a ton of volatility, which will benefit if they want to get in and out of these positions.
And by the way, this is a lesson in not necessarily believing everything that you see on either TV or in the news. You know, people are people. The fact is that just because you are on TV in terms of maybe an anchor or a host, or if you're writing, that doesn't mean that you're unbiased in something, right? You know, can you imagine someone who is a big fan of a company and owning the stock, looking at a report that was negative and then saying that, and then just, you know, with trying to write this up and hurting themselves? That's not going to happen. You know what I mean? So the thing is that there's always a bias, and be aware that when you're watching TV, when you're listening to a show, when you're listening to podcasts, just understand, where are they coming from? Where is the benefit to them in most cases? Not everything that is said is always slanted to benefit their own situation. But there are a lot of times that when you're looking at TV and when you're looking at, you know, oh well, you know, we just increased our expectations and our price on blank stock. Why? Well, somebody's got a $100 price target on a stock and the stock is now $130. They're wrong. So they're just going to go with the flow and increase it and make themselves look better. Or if somebody, like in this circumstance, is trying to push something in a conference, well, think about all the possibilities of why that is. They're not just being altruistic to help you out. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about, I think we need to talk about the elephant in the room.
Mm-hmm.
What's with Curzio Research?
Oh, yeah, I'm really excited to start my own company. I appreciate you asking about it. But we're going to launch a couple of newsletters, at least one newsletter in the next 2 to 3 weeks. Everything's getting fine-tuned here, making sure everything's all working properly, especially website and stuff like that. But really, you know, it's following my dad's footsteps. You know, for those of you who don't know or haven't listened to me, I mean, my dad was a newsletter writer. He was on TV a ton and on NBC Dateline. He did it for 30 years. He also managed money. So I actually grew up in this business and, you know, talking stocks at the dinner table when I was 15, 16, licking the envelopes and putting the stamps on my dad's newsletter and bringing them to the post office. We had thousands of subscribers and stuff. So for me, and working in this industry for such a long time, I'm really excited to announce that I'm launching my own company. And a lot has to do with the podcast and the following that we've had for Wall Street Unplugged. So many followers and so many people and being there and stuff. So I'm really excited. It's going to be a great newsletter. It's going to be affordable for everybody. It's going to be a newsletter based on small and mid-cap stocks that where we're going to level the playing field. Where you don't have, you're going to have access to everything else that these big guys have access to. Where even in when it comes to warrants and getting in these deals and private placements, getting access to a lot of these companies that you learn about when they're up 500, 600, 700%, you're going to get, you know, them a lot earlier from a guy who travels the world, who goes to the biggest conferences in the world to try to get as much information and the know-how and use all my contacts I've built up in over 20 years of this business and interviewing guys all the time in this podcast for over 10 years. To basically be in those inner circles and find out what's going on and talk about these trends before you hear on CNBC and every other media outlet like Bloomberg and stuff. So that's the goal of this newsletter. I'm really, really excited and we'll launch in a couple
weeks.
So let
me ask you something about the newsletter because this is something that I really do have a question about. I saw something recently that was kind of interesting with, and I wasn't exactly sure what this meant. Now, let me just take you through this. So there's a newsletter, your newsletter, anybody's newsletter. You have small stocks. I mean, you know, not very high volume kind of stocks, right? So you send your newsletter out, and it doesn't matter how many people. Let's say 1,000, 500, 5,000, whatever, 10,000 people, whatever, however many people get this newsletter, okay? And you say, I like XYZ stock. Now, XYZ stock trades, I don't know, 250,000 shares a day. You know, it's a $3 stock. You know, we're talking about the small cap under $5 kind of concept, right? The newsletter hits. People buy the stock ramps, right? How do you prevent that from getting too carried away?
Well, first we have buy up to prices. So say if a stock is $3 and we like it at $350, we'll say buy it up to $350. And sometimes it'll go a lot higher and there's excitement, there's traders in there. But for being in this newsletter industry and writing about small caps for over 20 years, what you see a lot is when you first come out these recommendations and you have a pretty big following, they are going to go up a lot. People want to try to get in early and it might go above that $325 price. So in order to diffuse that situation is one, be patient because a lot of times these stocks eventually come down, whether it's a couple weeks later. And two, even if it goes a little bit higher than that price, what I suggest is scaling in a little bit because sometimes, you know, it'll keep going higher. It'll base out 350, 375. A company may come out with news and it might go higher and you're like, oh, you know, I missed it and stuff. So, you know, scale in instead of buying. I think a big mistake investors make and even I made in the past is they take a full position right away. Instead of doing that, take a 25% position and build up this position over time. So if the stock goes higher, at least you still own it. If it goes lower a little bit, see what the news is. If it comes down below the price, again, people say, well, you know, as a trader, you should never average down, whatever. The goal is to get into this price around the 325 range. So if it does come down, it comes a little lower, you could always build up that position over time. But that's how you have to work around these positions, what happens. And it doesn't happen all the time, but even with some positions, this is how we counter that, which is a little bit of a risk and unfortunate because if your newsletter subscribers can't get into a stock and you buy up to price, then there's no reason for having a newsletter. So it's very important to, you know, we write about this and we have an investment guide. This way we help people with this. But we really want you to buy that stock under a buy up to price if you can, or scale in and try to get that price underneath by the time you have a full position and your average cost is around that price. And
you that's know, how I think that the scaling in is really important. If you think about this for just for a second, if you put your mindset, as you're listening to me right now, think about, okay, I got the newsletter, right? You know, anybody. This is a good conversation for any newsletter, okay? For anybody, not only from a newsletter, but if you see something in a newspaper, if you see something in a magazine, you know, if there's a recommendation, right? Somebody comes out with a recommendation. Think about the mentality. First of all, those people that want to get in are going to plow in, right? So you see a recommendation from Goldman Sachs on blah, blah, blah. Why does the stock move? Because people are just moving into it. Usually it happens a couple of days later because they've already released their recommendation to the internals. But nonetheless, So if you have a circumstance like Frank's talking about, so if you buy 25% or 33%, let's say, of a position, and it's a little bit towards the top end, et cetera, realize that you're not the only one doing this. Maybe other people buying full positions. The probability is for a stock that doesn't have a lot of volume, though, that any kind of pullback, those especially that bought well above because they just wanted to get in, are probably going to say, uh-oh, I stopped out here and it's going to come back down a bit. I would imagine that happens a lot of times. You know, back down
it happens,
to the,
probably 80, 90% of the time. You'll see the stock run up and within the next few weeks it's going to come back down to probably like your buy up to price right around there.
Right.
And you know, people have been following me for a long time know that, and I get very few complaints on this, that they can't get into the stock. They usually do. You know, it's extreme case when, you know, we recommend it, it goes higher with the recommendation, and it even goes higher, it just keeps running. Usually that stock comes back down.
Right, but a great thing to do is you take this 33% position, or whatever the exact number, even a half of the position, okay? And then, you know what? If it goes up and it runs away from you, like Frank said, you have the stock, okay? But there's going to be those cases where you also buy a stock and you bought it too high, you bought 50%, it's going to come way down. You know, it's going to come, for whatever reason, I don't know why, it's going to come way back down. Well, at least you got a piece of that and you can buy back into it up to the buy up to price. And if it kind of starts moving from there, great. If it hits your stop on the downside, fine also. But the point is, this way, you have to have a little bit of what's called risk management involved in this whole process, whether it's Frank, whether it's anybody, when they're writing about this, and let's say you totally buy into what your newsletter is saying. Still, the fact is that even if that is the case, think about you're playing a game with other players out there. Some of them are very excited and going to buy all into it. It doesn't really necessarily benefit you. But if you buy half the position or whatever the percent of the position is, and then it comes back down, you buy more, again, because it's still within that range. Or if it runs away from you, fine. You still have the stock and you'll do much better than just buying it too high of a price and then always stopping out.
Absolutely. And you mentioned something that's very important is risk management, not just with this stock, but we always have stop losses on all positions. You know why? Because sometimes I'm wrong, believe it or not.
Oh, come on.
So
come on, don't burst my bubble, man.
So if you're buying large caps, your percentage is going to be higher. The goal for this newsletter and for small cap investing is to really hit grand slams. And we've done that tremendously. We have four or five stocks that are up over 350%, stocks up to 600% because I was able to travel into the mining industry, get in there the last 2 years, find out the best ideas, and saying, hey, you know what? It's a cyclical industry. Once this industry turns around, it's going to create monster gains. One of the biggest bear markets in 40 years in the resource sector. I didn't think it'd turn around this quick. It did, and
it was
fortunate.
It was quick.
And some of the stocks we recommend. However, sometimes it doesn't happen where, you know, your thesis doesn't work out and these stocks can really get hit. You want to limit your loss. You want to continue to have money on the table. And I think that's a big key here because I've seen a lot of mining newsletters, and this isn't going to be mining focused. It's going to be everything focused, tech, energy, you name it, biotech. But the last 4 years, 3.5 years before this recent 6-month rally, you know, these guys were getting in stocks at $10, $11 and, you know, they'll go down to $8, tell them to buy more, go down to $6, buy more, and they're a dollar. And you have to realize at a dollar, it's a complete wipeout because, I mean, you're looking at a stock that has to go up 900,000% just to get to your original cost basis, and that's probably not going to happen. It's not even close to happening now. These stocks aren't near their highs. They're at their 52-week highs. They're not near their 4-year highs. They're still down 50, 60%. So you have to have risk management in everything you do because you don't want to get crushed. You don't know, get the election, possibly 2 Fed rate hikes coming up. That's just in the next 6 months. Who knows what's going to happen even after this? So you always have to be careful and have those stops in place. Very, very important.
So there's a lot of people wondering, okay, I get it. Okay, Frank. Okay, Andrew, I get it. How do I talk to Frank? How do I get in touch with Frank? You said there's no particular website that's currently up, but there's somewhere else that
is what? There is. It's frankcurzio.com is currently up. We just don't, the back end's going to be there where you can subscribe to the newsletter pretty soon. And if you want to, you can get on my email list by going to frankcurzio.com. You'll have all my podcasts and stuff like that and all pictures. I update, I write. You know, you get on that free email list. I'm not going to bombard you with 500. Spam emails of all garbage. So it's really cool. It's a solid list. People love being on it because I give them really great information. And also you can email me at curzio1@gmail.com. That goes directly to me. And, you know, that's how I answer questions on my Friday podcast, which is Frankly Speaking. It's just a Q&A. I get some questions. I just answer them, have fun with it about stocks, markets, economy, and even sports and stuff like that. So I have a little fun with that one.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about, before we leave this one little topic here, just give me, I don't know, one or two of your favorite little stocks right now.
Two stocks right now. I think a great opportunity where your audience could make a triple-digit gain inside 12 months. And again, you put all of the stuff on your website, so it's good. I love that you do that because we should all be held accountable. It's very important. People have recommendations. They forget they make them 3 weeks later. A company called Brazil Resources just came out with game-changing news, and the market doesn't understand it. And they don't understand it because it's a Canadian-listed stock. The symbol is BRI.V, and you can also buy it on over-the-counter. Which I don't recommend because it's not really a regulated exchange, and Toronto exchanges are all great, and Canada exchange. But here's a company run by a guy named Amir Adnani, a good friend. I was fortunate to follow this company for a while. And he, instead of like the whole mining industry and everyone selling assets and all full of debt, what this guy did is start a new gold company and started purchasing these assets, these gold assets, for pennies on the dollar. And he's built it up to 10 million ounces of gold. Guys, it's a massive amount of gold in the ground. So 10 million ounces. It's not just in Latin America. It's also in the U.S. as well, building this up. And he just came out and purchased another asset for just $10 million that had about $400 million of work on it and drilling and stuff like that. I think it's more like $200, $300 million of work on it over the years. He was able to purchase it for like $10
million. Why?
And because it's such a depressed industry and it's so horrible that, remember, these are a lot of these projects are not developed yet. So they're just sitting there and you have to pay your employees. You have to pay everybody. And the only way to generate money is to issue more shares. So a lot of these assets have been selling. You have no idea. I mean, think about the credit crisis, and it's worse than the credit crisis. That's what the resource market was doing over the past year or two. So here's a guy that said, listen, I'm going to have great backers. He's got billionaire backers. He started a company, Brazil Resources, built up to $10 million. They just purchased this asset. And the reason why they're able to get in there is because they issued shares instead of cash. Because the company said, you know what? Brazil Resources is so undervalued. Let's do this deal in stock. They got 1 million warrants as well. It resulted in just 5% dilution, right? They just came out with the 43-101. They have to come out with that by law, independent study. And they thought they were buying 3 to 4 million ounces, and it turns out to be almost 8 million ounces. So they're sitting on 18 million ounces of gold in the ground, which is normally valued at $40. Goldcorp just took over a company called Caminac, and they paid about $75 per ounce in the ground. And you're looking at Amir and Brazil Resources, their 18 million is being valued. The 18 million ounce is being valued at $11 an ounce in the ground right now.
Wow.
So I think people don't understand the situation. You're going to look at a stock that went from 50 cents to 260, 270, and you might think you missed it. It's a totally different company. It's, all the resource companies went up. This is a company that's doing things right. I don't think they got this news, which just came out a couple weeks ago. It just came out a couple days ago. They purchased this asset over a month ago. But a fantastic opportunity for investors as long as gold prices gradually move higher.
Yeah.
If they go lower, everything in gold is going to come lower. But if you're a believer that gold's going to go through 1,400 to 1,500 over the next 2 years, which is not a crazy forecast with negative bonds and all over the place and monetary policy and everything going on with countries, this company could easily return 100%. Even if you value it at $40, you're looking at a gain of 300-400% from here. So the gains are incredible. The risk, I think, is limited as long as gold stays here or goes higher. But I think from risk reward standpoint, it's one of the best companies that I know right now. After this news came out, it's public release two days ago.
Cool. Any others that are maybe not like on a different exchange and more localized?
I would say Gold Standard Ventures is another one. I'm really focusing on mining. I like biotech as well. Gold Standard Ventures is a guy, in the Carlin Trend, one of the biggest gold areas in the world. I think Nevada would be ranked fourth or fifth if it was a country in terms of gold production. And they were able to secure a massive land package. And they just got Goldcorp to invest with them. They got a whole bunch. They just came out with amazing drilling results. And there's literally several 20 million ounce deposits all around these guys, and now that they're drilling, they're finding out that this could have the same thing. And the stock went from 50 cents like 225. But the fact that you have billionaire investors, Oceana Gold invested, again, you talk about a junior mining company where these guys are investing in these junior mining companies because they think how big it could be. So you want to make sure, even in Brazil Resources, where these guys are up 500% from their lows, not one insider sold a share yet. So their goal is not, this wasn't the goal. The goal is to be 10, 20 times bigger than this. And you have to make sure, especially in the mining industry, that you're following great guys. Jonathan Ard runs Gold Standard Ventures, GSV. You find that on American Exchange. And they have great investors in these companies and great projects in politically friendly areas. So that's one of the things that I look for in companies like that.
All right, let's back up and let's go from mining and small caps and little bitties and, kind of interesting opportunities that could be just enormous and all. Let's kind of back it all the way and talk about some economics some things related to markets. Mm-hmm. Now, we know we have coming up next week, we have a Fed meeting. Now, here's my playbook, by the way. I think I've talked about this before to a few people, and maybe even on a couple of podcasts in the past. On DH Unplugged, I think I talked about this last week with John C. Dvorak. Tuesday nights, by the way, late night, you can get DH Unplugged. That comes hot off the press when I speak with John C. Dvorak. We have a pretty good repertoire and actually a lot of comedy that goes on there, or at least some fun. Maybe not comedy. Fun laughs. Well, anyway, not as straight as some of the other shows. I talked about, you know what? Here's the game plan. And if anybody hasn't sniffed this out yet, I don't know what you're missing here. But just take a year ago. They were hinting about a rate increase in September, hinting about, you know, possibly moving and all that and doing all. And then September came. If you remember what happened, they kind of went, you know, just said, oh, no, can't do it at this point. Everybody's like, what? Wait a minute. We were all getting ready for a rate hike, right? And then they hiked in December at the end of the year. I think that is the same exact game plan, because if you look at what happened last year, markets were very disappointed and people were very disappointed about them not moving in September. They move in December, markets went down a bit, dollar came higher and all that. But when you look back on it and you see, if you just follow the same game plan, well, everything is straightened out just fine and dandy. So I don't think they're going to deviate. You know, the Fed's a big fan of looking at history and how things played out. And I just don't see, with some of the negative or light reports we've seen from the manufacturing sectors and the service sector came down pretty hard. Employment looks fine. Inflation looks relatively fine. But there's some holes around in other areas. But I just don't see them really hiking in September, as dovish as they've been, and probably just going to the same playbook that they did last year. What do you think about that?
I think so. I think it'd be pretty crazy doing anything before the election, right? I think, and plus the data doesn't really support a rate hike, a recent data, right? I mean, we should just mention, you saw a little weak activity in manufacturing, even retail sales and stuff. So if you're looking at that part, I cannot see them doing anything in September to shake up the markets before this election, which is going to get really crazy, especially when the debates begin in what is it, like a week from now, mm-hmm. a little bit longer. But December sounds right. It could. And I can tell you one thing, and not to harp on his theme, but it's one of the sectors I like, along with biotech, that's gotten crushed lately. So I'm finding a lot of ideas. But you know, if you look at the last rate hike of 25 basis points last December, the best performing sector happened to be gold, which is gold price, I think, are up, what, 20-25% since then?
Which is pretty amazing, actually. It's the opposite of what you would think would happen.
Yeah, so remember, even though rates are going high, you're seeing around the whole world is doing everything they can to stimulate. They're trying to create inflation, and it's not really working, right? I mean, it's working in assets. They're inflating assets. So the longer they keep interest rates lower, I think they're backed into a corner here. You're seeing the market creating bubbles when people are buying McDonald's for 20-plus times earnings and, you know, just for their 2.5-3% yield, with a company that has trouble growing sales over the last 5 years. And look at utilities.
Breakfast.
I mean, utilities.
Right, breakfast was the big thing. Breakfast.
Yeah, I know.
I can get breakfast. Crazy. We should move the stock up 30% because they serve breakfast.
I know. And not only that, Andrew, what's more concerning is these stocks, you know, buybacks are pretty cool if you're buying back your stock at cheap valuations. These guys are buying back not just McDonald's, but a lot of these companies with their dividends. They're increasing their dividend and they're spending a ton of money buying back their stock at their most expensive valuations in 10 years. It tells you that they're not finding a better use for this cash, and that's how innovation is created, right? You're using that cash, you're putting them into different things, you're putting it, let's try to open up more restaurants, let's try different things. Instead, they're buying back stock, the money's low, and I get it's going to increase earnings, that's how these guys all get paid, and so far it's working, and it's increasing, you know, the stock. But if you're looking, you're actually taking away from growth down the line, and not only that, because you're not investing in growth, you're investing in your stock instead, but you're looking at this whole interest rate environment and you're keeping them low, it's creating a massive bubble that's going to continue to get worse and worse. And we're not even near the top. Remember, guys, when people say bubble, they think you should run away, right? But if you look at the NASDAQ and you look at before it crashed, I mean, what did it double from 1999 to March 2000? Right. I mean, it was already in a bubble before that, but you still saw 100% gain. We're talking about the index, not even a stock, but our technology, the whole index doubled. So we can go a lot higher from here, but it's going to result in even more of a catastrophe later on, but we have to change this policy. And I think you're right, in December, I think we'll probably get a 25 basis point hike, but I don't see them doing anything before the election.
So before the election, obviously, because you're thinking there's going to be some volatility, you know, it can be some issues. How do investors, how do they set themselves up, you know, with a lot of these unknowns? You know, we have the Bank of Japan next week. We have the Fed next week. Okay, fine, whatever they do. But, you know, we see this all of a sudden when, you know, you could snap your finger. And we talked about this about 3 weeks ago on the podcast. You know, snap your finger, you know what, traders are going to come back from wherever they were, in, you know, whether it's just they were kind of in summer mode, still trading, or whether they were actually, you know, away on vacation for a few weeks in August and came back. And after Labor Day, volatility and volume should pick up. And because, by the way, because there has been so much stock taken off the markets due to stock buybacks, right, there's less actual shares to trade, which could significantly have the effect of increasing volatility. Right, there's less shares chasing around either direction here. And that's what we saw, right? We saw like, you know, that 394 point down day. Then we saw kind of a spike back, then back down. We didn't have a 100 point move in the Dow for like 2 months, 3 months. And all of a sudden, now it's daily. So how should investors deal with this? Maybe create some kind of a way to not only just mentally deal with this, but protect their portfolios over the next 3 months, if in fact there's going to be a volatility session going on here due to all the different things that are happening?
Hey, look, it's a great question. There's different ways, right? And I think it depends what type of investor you are. If you're a trader and you're looking to get in and out, I mean, they have inverse ETFs, which would be the easiest way for the individual investor to use. And you know they're not as efficient, but they will protect you if you're buying those inverse, you know, S&P funds and stuff like that. It's not something that I don't think Andrew would do or money managers would
do
necessarily
that. Do. What do you mean? We do that. So, no, some we do that with our active portfolios, of course.
You would act the portfolios.
I mean, you have to do the right ones. There's some of them that suck. Exactly. Some are terrible. You have to do exactly. them on only a few different ones.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I meant. So if you're doing them on the larger ones, have a lot of volume, that's one way to protect yourself. If you're a trader, you may look for inefficiencies in the market. If the market does come down, you may see, you know, maybe healthcare or something. If Trump's numbers go even higher into the election, you know, that's what you have to worry about, because I think Trump is more of uncertainty.
And no take kidding. Politics out no of kidding. It.
So it's much more uncertainty. The markets hate uncertainty. Right. And I'm in agreement with Cuban, even though I don't know why Cuban, I know why, but he needs to be in the media all the time and, you know, instead of focusing on his basketball team. And I like Cuban, but I think he's right. If Trump gets elected, you're going to see the market probably come down probably a lot, because there's a lot of uncertainty. What is he going to change? What policies is he going to change? Foreign trade and stuff, where it's kind of like the status quo if Clinton gets elected. Again, keeping politics aside. But if you're a long-term investor, I want to explain something to you, because, you know, even investors who are probably listening to this, and you don't have to be that old, where it's, you know, 1987 market crash, you have 2001, 2002 recession, you know, we had scares on Ebola, we had cow disease, you had September 11 terrorist attacks, 2008 recession, and if you look at the market right now, it's just off its, you know, all-time highs. All right, it's down a little bit, but still. So, you know, basically, if you bought stocks in early 1980s and fell asleep and woke up today, you're perfectly fine. You're not looking at what the next manufacturing point is going to be. You're not looking at what retail sales are. You're not even looking at what the next president's going to be, because you're a long-term investor.
You're probably not even looking.
It doesn't matter. But here's the key, though. It doesn't mean that your portfolio is not going to get hit, but you have to be careful, because some of these stocks are, you know, for the first time, which we really didn't see in 2008, yes, the S&P 500 came down. But you're talking about high-quality, safe stocks that are trading more expensive than they've traded in 10, 20 years. And these are the stocks I worry about, because they're in people's 401ks that they don't even know about, right? They're on their job. They're professionals at whatever they do, not really in stocks. They don't know the funds in their 401k own, right? You know, tons of McDonald's and tons of Kimberly-Clark and you know, a lot of very super Clorox, which are, you know, trading off the charts, right? It's very expensive. These are the companies that could get really hit. So you want to buy cheap companies with high dividends that are actually growing. And I like AT&T's, GE's, with industrial internet, you know, machines learning from each other, massive multi-trillion dollar trend. AT&T, the DirecTV acquisition, they're actually going to generate, see, 10% earnings on top bottom line growth. So you have a nice dividend paying there. And finally, that they're growing through that DirecTV transition, and they're putting fiber everywhere, which is going to, I think, really take a lot of business from the cable companies. And you'll see more DirecTV coming to people's houses. But, you know, those are companies I would focus on that have growth, have dividend, that are cheap. And those are three stocks that I like from that point of view. But long term,
AT&T, GE, what was the other one?
AT&T, GE, and what was the other one that I said? Did I say another one?
You said DirecTV, but that's now...
DirecTV. So those two. Those are two ones. So DirecTV, AT&T, those are the stocks that I really focus around, mm-hmm. that I think pay a high dividend and also have huge growth potential and are also pretty cheap. You look at GE, it doesn't seem cheap. They're about to return all that money from shutting off their GE Capital division back to shareholders. So, you know, you're going to get a special dividend, even more of an increase. And wait till you see the growth that's being significantly... Yeah, I mean, you look at the analysts, nobody has that growth factored in. I think you're going to see exceptional growth. I've done a lot of research on the industrial internet and what that's going to mean for businesses. You're seeing it right now. Manufacturing slowing down. You're seeing service sectors go much, much higher. That whole manufacturing economy is becoming 100% automated. And GE has the best cloud services in there with Prexit, which is going to be fantastic going forward. I think nobody's really talking about that right now. Mm,
great stuff. Well, our guest today, Frank Curzio. You can, of course, find him on frankcurzio.com. We mentioned, and he'll just mention it again, you know, his newsletter is going to be coming out shortly. You can find out more about that right there. He is the founder and president of Curzio Research. You can listen to him all the time. He's a couple different podcasts. The one you want him to look at is Wall Street Unplugged. Also, Frankly Speaking, where you can ask questions and get some of his input and insight into that as well. So, Frank, I want to thank you and you know, appreciate you coming aboard today.
Thanks. And how'd you do on your fishing trip? Did you catch anything?
No.
Did you drink a lot?
No. you know, you got to get a rule. You have to catch a fish before you can have a beer.
If I don't catch fish, then I drink beer.
Gotcha.
So, I have a different. We have different models.
I hear you. All right, thanks for coming aboard. I appreciate it. And listen, by the way, everyone out there, if you do want to find out more information, just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There's also a little section on there that says Ask Andrew if you want to ask any questions of me, or if you want me to comment on any of your things. I talked last week about bond funds and some of my concerns about bonds, and you need to be very aware of what's underlying any of your bond, mutual fund, or ETF portfolios. I'll answer any questions there as well. Just go over to the site and click it. You can actually upload your files and some information for me to look at too, if you want to. There's a little file upload button there. I want to thank you for joining me, and we'll see you next week. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.